Well, it's so good to see you again. I wanted to start off, and I haven't seen you all in a while, and those of you that were in the Bible study, I already warned them that they were going to get a little bit of an overlap, double dose of the Bible study and the message that I have for you today. And just as a real quick recap, I haven't seen too much of you in the last month. I was on a trip with my youngest son, Zachary, and we have a tradition in our family when our children turn 21, we take them to London, or I take them to London. Becky has been many, many times, and we've been there together, and we just kind of, I don't know even how it started with our oldest at the time, but I just had this need to want to show them another culture, something that they would understand, so we wouldn't have to translate every sign, every menu, every map, and I've been fortunate enough to travel quite a bit for business and pleasure, but London's very special to me. So we had a week and a little bit, almost a week and a half together. One of the reasons I do pick England is I do believe, as the church does teach, this is where the throne of David now rests. The kings and queens of Israel in the latter centuries are crowned in that country. And obviously there is a great connection between the United States and Britain, both culturally as well as prophetically. I quoted from Samuel Johnson, and I've learned this well, when a man is tired of London, he is tired of life. And I asked the Bible study group, I'll ask this larger group, because a few of you weren't at the Bible study. How many of you have been to London? Yeah, see, it's probably the same percentage. How many want to go back? How many of you are 21? I see. Now, it's a beautiful place, so we saw a lot of the sights. We saw the Tower of London. One of the interesting parts, I don't know how many times I've been to it, but we had a very good beef eater, you know, the guys with the hats and the royal tunic and the looks like a nice skirt. He was talking about the beheadings, and he said that when they beheaded people in the tower, they would take their head off their shoulders, raise the bloody head, and proclaim to the crowd, "Behold the head of a traitor." And then they would take the head, stick it on a pike, and parade it through town. And the executioner, until he did that, wouldn't be paid. And when he was paid, he was given his severance pay. It's true. Look it up. What do you mean? Look it up. Look it up. No, we saw Hampton Court. We saw Houses of Parliament. We visited just a couple, two or three pubs, maybe four, five, six, seven, eight. We saw a few pubs, and we tried not to see the same thing twice, and it was a lot of fun. We had Sabbath services at Brickett Wood. Those of you that have been there, it's a beautiful location, very historic, and every time you go there, they always want to take you where? To the campus. And so we had a wonderful time there. It was the only time it rained on us was on the Sabbath in the afternoon, just for a very brief time. And the fellow was showing us around, very pleasant fellow. He said, "Oh, I'm so sorry about this rain." And I said, "This isn't just rain. This is British rain. It's different." And he said, "No, it's not. It's just like rain you get where." I said, "Okay, right. It's different. It's the same." But Sunday, we put on our clothes for Sabbath. And because Zach has graduated from Fire Academy, we visited a couple of fire stations, which was very, very interesting. They were very gracious to him, showed him everything about the fire station. We went to Westminster, but after that, we went to services at Westminster Abbey. I know, the pagan, heathen, unwashed Gentiles. But I wanted to show him a different type of service. How many of you have been to Westminster Abbey? Yeah, see. How many of you have been to Westminster Abbey services? Yeah. No, I don't see anybody. Maybe one. Me. Zach, you've been there. You can raise your hand. Okay. Yeah. And so we dressed in our Sabbath clothes, and we walked in, and I was telling the Bible study group that the deacons there have these beautiful robes on, and they've got this huge staff or scepter, and they stomp it when you approach, and you're here for services, and yes, we are. And they could tell we didn't have a British accent, so I'm sure that we didn't have an athletic T-shirt on that said "Buy beer, drink beer, and all that, which is the way most Americans come into Westminster Abbey, unfortunately. And because we were dressed appropriately, and we did that for a reason, they sat us in the choiry, in the wooden choiry, and there's only two rows of seats for the parishioners. And over to the side, everybody sits in folding chairs, and our fellow Americans, Italians, and French, and Germans, you know, are in T-shirts, sandals, and whatever for church services. They make them sit over there. And I knew that, so we dressed appropriately, and it was just this gorgeous, it was almost like a throne. There was about 20 of them on each side. Music was gorgeous. Service lasted about an hour. And the singing lasted about 45 minutes, which was gorgeous. And so I wanted to show Zach that, and I've got some very fond memories of being there many, many times for services, to show him something different, to compare. And when we got done with the service, which was, again, very short, the size, length of a sermonette, I asked him how it went, and he said, "It was shallow." And I said, "Oh, really interesting." He says, "There wasn't any depth to it." He says, "It was, our sermonettes are better. So you guys got an attaboy from 8,000 miles away." Today, what I'd like to talk to you about has part of its genesis in the reading that I heard in London on Deuteronomy 11, which was what the Bible study was about, what our eyes have seen. But today, for the message, I'd like to again steal, plagiarize, hijack, borrow, from a message that somebody, a lot of you know, Mr. Ron Dart. And I heard this message, and I called him, and I said, "I plan on mercilessly plagiarizing, stealing your message. If it goes badly, you will get full credit." He said, "That's quite all right. Would you like my notes?" And so, the audio was enough. I've discussed with you today two paths, or two roads, two doors, and I've entitled it, "Do You Feel Like a Grape?" Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew chapter 7. This section is referenced also in Luke chapter 13, but not as completely. Now, these are verses that you'll know very, very well, and we're going to read them. Chapter 7, verse 13. Jesus says, and this is interestingly enough, when I heard the special music, it's from this same chapter, not too many verses away. The Do Not Judge chapter. Again, a very lovely melody, and obviously the words were very well chosen. Jesus gives very simple little pericopes. He does a few verses, then he changes subjects. He goes from do not judging to keep asking and seeking and knocking. And then in verse 13, he changes subjects again. And he says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it, because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it." Now, Luke is very, very similar, but not as complete. And this is where we're going to take the bulk of our time today, in these two verses. These verses are famous. They're very, very well known. They're known both within Christianity and elsewhere. The two doors, the two ways, the narrow gate and the broad gate. The straight gate and the very open gate. It makes me think of the way we go on a road or where we go in the different cities in this country when we travel. Now, there's only really one way to get to London from here, and that's really only by plane. You could go by boat, but that's not really practical or affordable. But when we go to San Francisco, and I'm a native Californian and have been there many, many times, there's two main ways to get to San Francisco from Los Angeles. There are others, but there are two main. You can go up the 5 or you can go up the 1, Highway 1. You can go up the 101, but 1 and the 5 I'm using for a very specific reason. It's interesting, when we lived on the East Coast, that freeways and highways and roads back east don't have names like they have out here. They're very, very different. They have specific non-numerical names. For instance, there is for those of you in the New Jersey, New York area, there's the Garden State Parkway, yeah? And there's the Turnpike, yeah? So, and anytime you go north-south in New Jersey, you pay, right? You got to pay on the Turnpike, you got to pay on the Parkway. So, I knew where I had to work, being a Californian, and I'm used to a what? A freeway. Yeah. I went west, right? So that I wouldn't have to pay the tolls, which are quite severe. But we have the Garden State Park, we have the Turnpike, but here it's called the Five. We really don't call it the Santa Ana Freeway because it's not the Santa Ana Freeway up in this part of the world. What is it, the Golden State Freeway up here? Yeah, Golden State. We get on the 10. We get on the 91. We get on the 101, the 101. Or we'll take the 15 or 215. But the 5, Highway 5, is a quick shot to San Francisco. It's very direct. It's very straight. It's all interstate. It's well paved. There are stops along the way. You pass grassy field after grassy field after grassy field, some herds of cattle, a couple of large truck stops, a couple of waste treatment facilities, and it's hundreds and hundreds of miles of fields and more fields. But it is very quick. But it is very, very boring. I have driven the 5 when we lived in the Bay Area over and over again. I know it like the back of my hand. That's how we got home, because we wanted to get there quick. We wanted to get down to Southern California to see friends and family. The one, the Highway 1, is exactly the opposite. If you've ever been on it, you know what I mean. The drive to San Francisco is beautiful. It is spectacular, but it is also very winding. It goes through many hills. It goes in a little bit inlet, and then inside, away from the ocean, and then back out to the ocean, sometimes very dramatically. It's very narrow, very narrow. In fact, in some places, there's only two lanes. And when the road washes out, there's no road. But it is beautiful. It is not boring. It is spectacularly beautiful. But it is the long road. It is the long way. And it's very different. Its scenery is majestic, and it's also very scary. That's why many people, when they go to San Francisco, take the 5 up, right, quickly, and then take the 1 down, right? So they're on the inside, not on the outside, and those cliffs. But it winds through Santa Barbara and Hearst Castle and Carmel, and you can stop along many ways. It's very, very beautiful. And so, as pretty as it is, as beautiful as it is also a little dangerous. But when we compare the 5 and we compare the 1, those two highways, in getting to and from the Bay Area, they are different. They are very, very different. And the people that drive them, as I've just explained, they're very different as well. And I've driven both. Unfortunately, I've driven the 5 freeway 100 times, 200 times. I don't know how many times. The 1, I can count the number of times that I've driven it. And I've remembered just about every one of them. So Matthew 7 talks about two gates, one narrow and one wide. But there is so much, and you're going to get a double dose of Greek as well today, there's so much Greek in these two short verses, and we're going to explore them. And hopefully, there are things here that you may not have seen before. The word narrow gate here in verse 13, enter, he says, by the narrow gate, is the word stenos. It means just exactly that. It is narrow. It is only used twice, used here in Matthew and used in Luke's version, where he barely mentions it. It means that it is difficult to get to when it's straight. There are obstacles possibly standing close about it. It's a very colorful word. It just doesn't mean narrow. It means something, if you picture in your mind's eye, that someone's trying to get into maybe like an old garden gate, and there's things in the way, and you've got to look for it, to find it, to get through it. And you have to step through it, because it's not easy to get through it. It takes some work. It takes some effort. It's hard to find. It's hard to find. The broad and wide gate, the word broad and wide here is the word plateia. It's interesting that there's two different words used here for broad, plateia, and wide, different word, eukouros. It's like a main thoroughfare. Very, very different. It's only used in a few places. One of them is in Revelation 21:21, where it talks about the new cities of Jerusalem, or the streets of the city. These are broad. And in Greek times, these were so broad, these Greek cities, they would be 2, 3, 4 chariots wide. Those of you that have been overseas and visited either in Turkey or Greece, some of the ancient ruins, you'll see the main roads, the paved roads, right? They're very wide. Some of them are 1/2 to 3/4 the width of this room. They're huge. We'd call them a pedestrian freeway. They're that wide. They're easy to get on. But, he says, they lead to destruction. It's interesting where he uses in verse 13, he says a command, first off, by you should enter this narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And that word destruction is the word that also means damnation and perishing and waste. His final conclusion is horrible and very bad. But you'll get where you're going. You'll arrive where you want to be if you take that path. It's like this freeway. It's like the I-5 or the I-15. I've got nothing against the Interstate 5 or Interstate 15. I have to use them all the time, so I dare not curse them. I have to use them a lot. But they are unbelievably busy, aren't they? Many people go on these freeways. If you'll remember, until they opened up the 210, right? Right? Until they opened that up, getting to where? Vegas, backed up everywhere. So the I-15 and 215... many people go this way. Why do they go this way? It's popular. There's lots of other people to see, right? Nobody likes to drive alone at night. So it's popular. It's easy. You just get on. There's lots of exits. You get on. It ends, right, in Vegas or on the 5. It ends in Northern California all the way up to Sacramento if you want to go that far. But it's also these freeways are some of the most deadly, not just in California, but these roads are also the most deadly in the United States and therefore the world. In 2007, the I-5 made the National Highway Safety and Transportation Authority, it made its top 10 twice. One for the section in San Diego, one for the section in L.A. Because it goes through so many counties toward Northern California, if they had it at the top 20, it would be in the next 5, 10 through 20. That is how deadly. Hundreds of people lose their lives every year in California on these roads. One of the reports made this comment. Because the I-5 and its sister, the I-15, are so lethal, one report said, ironically, many fatalities on this stretch may be because the road is so straight and so wide. That road will put you to sleep. I've almost fallen asleep on the 5. It's where the truckers use. They'll use the 5, and they'll use it because it is so big. It'll get them there fast, but it's hard to stay awake. It's so easy. Broad is this gate. We see it like a freeway. Jesus wasn't talking about a freeway, but we have these things in our lives to give us a great analogy. Like a freeway, it's easy. You speed up, right? You're on your way, you're having a great time, and then it gets really hard to stay awake, to be alert, to be aware. I think we can relate to this. I think we can relate to the broad gate. The broad gate is 21st century planet Earth. The broad gate is 21st century the United States. The broad gate is 21st century Southern California. We got it all, don't we? We have it all right here. People love to come here, right? 32 million people. I asked somebody, they said, you have 32 million people. I said, what do you think? We're having kids at gunpoint out here? Where do you think the people are coming from? They're immigrating here from everywhere, not just south of the border, from all over the world. You will see so many accents here. Here, so many different cultures here. Oh, I thought London was culturally diverse. L.A.'s pretty close. Pretty close. People want to come here. But living in this world, the ways of this world, is like driving while you're asleep, isn't it? We sometimes go through life when we're not quite awake, not quite there. Indeed, walking while asleep. Our attention span is so short. We're so medicated. It just baffles me when we watch the television. I think it's directed at my age group. Unbelievable. I mean, there's the ones, the medications that shouldn't be on TV, in my humble opinion, at 3 in the afternoon with kids watching. But I'm telling you, I didn't know how so many of my over 50 friends, relatives, and other age bracket people, we have so much wrong with us. Our feet, our backs, our legs, our heads, our lungs, our stomachs, our kidneys. Nothing's right. I mean, I get sick because I think I'm sick while I'm watching it. And I don't take any of that stuff. We are so medicated. I don't want to, by reference, bring up Mr. Michael Jackson's demise. Do you know the drug report came out this week? How many of you heard of the drug report? It was 16 different medications, half of which were to offset the other 8. And I do not say that to his shame at all. He is a casualty, isn't he? He's truly a casualty. He had to have that prescribed for him. Those medications that you see on the TV and on here on the radio, those have to be prescribed for people. You just can't walk into Rite Aid and pick them up. And yet we do. And yet we do. We live in an absolutely over-medicated society. And aside from the medical issues, I think that is exactly, specifically, what Satan wants. If you had an enemy, if you had somebody you wanted to defeat, what would you do? You want them completely and utterly disoriented, right? When you're disoriented, you don't know what to do. You don't know how to escape. And that is exactly where Satan wants this world. Because he is the gatekeeper on the wide gate, isn't he? He's the toll collector at the wide gate. He seeks to put us in such a stupor. He seeks to have us so mesmerized, we don't know where we are or where we're going. He does that, indeed he does, through the entertainment. We have so much to pick from. We have so much to choose from. We had, it was interesting, I think Mr. Hopkinson did a very good job with the technology. But you can see, as he said, we have never had this technology before, ever. And it can be used, as it was in the first message, for great good. This great knowledge. But we can be so blinded by it. I heard heard one report that the next medical epidemic will not be swine flu. It will be called text thumbing, where teenagers and those in their 20s will have thumbs at least a foot to a foot and a half long by the next generation. I don't text. It's a tool of Satan the devil. Do you know they have banned texting in boardrooms now? I mean, people have to be told. Is there anybody texting here, by the way, right now? Cell phones off. All cell phones off. The deacon, you see anybody with cell phones and they're texting? You got it, right? You on that? I'll get you one of those robes I saw in London. You can take care of that? People have been killed while texting, haven't they? Haven't they related the last two train wrecks to the engineers texting while driving? This is a symptom of our disorientation while on and through the wide, broad gate. Our entertainment, we've got so much, isn't it great? 16, 17 movies out at one time. What'd you see this week? What did I see? Sexual relations, everything, anything, all the time, every time, anywhere. That's what we believe in. It's interesting to note also that as we look at the entertainment, we look at the relationships that we have with one another, the broad and wide gate also gives us a spiritual fog. It's all relative. It really doesn't matter. I noticed that when we were in London, and this has been three times in the last 6-7 years, the churches, you know what the average national attendance in Great Britain is every Sunday? Less than 10% of the population attend church. The churches are empty. The churches are virtually empty on Sunday. I mean, we went into Westminster Abbey, which is, I don't know, 30 times the size of this building. If we were to count the number of people there for the service at 10 a.m., it would have been under 100. And that's Westminster Abbey. This is almost ground zero from the Anglican Church. In fact, I think it is. That is the main worship center. So we're in a spiritual fog. This is exactly where Satan wants us, where he wants the world, where he wants the church. We have been lulled into this because this way is so broad. It's so easy. It's so fast. It's so fun. It's so popular. The narrow gate, verse 14, Jesus expands on this in verse 14. He says, because narrow is this gate, narrow is this gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life. Not that leads to the gate. It's after the gate. The gate is narrow. We know that word. And difficult. This is difficult to find. It's a difficult gate. It's a difficult road. But the word difficult is a fascinating word in the Greek. It's laibo, which means to afflict and to suffer tribulation and trouble. Why would anybody want to go on this road? Why would anybody want to go through this gate? Things a pain in the neck to find. You've got to stumble over something to get through it. Once you're on it, it's tortuous. It's a tribulation. It's trouble. But it also means, in its root word, it means to press, like a grape. I brought you some grapes. Like a grape. It means to press, compress, and grind down like a grape. Hard, narrow, straightened, contracted. Again, metaphorically, it means to trouble and to afflict and distress. If you were a grape and you were being crushed, you'd feel like you were being compressed. You would feel this. We do feel this. Kind of like a grape. How many of you feel, I don't know, show of hands. How many of you feel like a grape sometimes? You've been squeezed and pushed and pressed and afflicted and troubled. And it just seems that one issue right after another, sometimes greater, sometimes smaller, occurs in our lives. Health issues are followed by financial issues, which are followed by relational issues, which are cycled all over again by health and finances, over and over and over again. Each one of us in this room, each one of us in this room has had troublous times, has been compressed, constricted, has been afflicted, has had tribulation. Internally, to you, I'm not talking about the church as a whole, the body of Christ, I'm talking about to the individual. It's very often that we don't remember the good things that happened to us, but we surely do remember the bad. The bad seem to stay with us. The bad seem to come up again and again, and we replay them over and over again. I had a conversation with a member recently. We were talking about the sin that we commit. We think that somewhere in God's word it says that the sin that we commit and are forgiven of, it has been removed. It has, theologically. It has toward our salvation. Then why is it that we remember it? Why is it that we can't stop sometimes recalling it? It's not forgotten. It burned a hole sometimes so deep inside us that it's difficult to forget. We know we've been forgiven. We understand that God has removed it. And God has technically forgotten it. But in reality, we haven't, have we? We haven't. Each of us in this room have had this press, this crush of life. It's like a bunch of grapes. We've had everything squeezed right out of us. There's nothing left sometimes but a shell. How do we know? Well, the elders know because we're the ones in the room that pray for you. We're the ones you ask. That's how we know. It happens to us. It happens to every person in this room. I heard of a story before services of one of our littlest members, a horrible ordeal he went through. The father prayed for the child, and the child apparently was healed. All of us, whether we are 5, 10, or 85, go through this. And each of us have gone through this gate that was so hard to find, but find this road so difficult. But Jesus says in the end of this, he says, this gate is narrow, the path is difficult, but it leads to life. What kind of life? If this is the life, if this is all there is, as the book of Corinthians says, if this is all there is, I don't want it. This isn't worth it. Paul says, if this only in this life we have hope in Jesus Christ, we are of all men most what? That's right, miserable, pitiable. It's horrible if this is all there is. But Jesus says, he says this in great terms, that this is eternal life. That's the implication. He says to enter into this gate. He says nothing about the road up to the gate, but he says you've got to find that gate. You've got to find that gate, stumble through it, open that gate, and go through it. And then he talks about what happens after. He asks us to enter this incredibly difficult road. This life of seeming affliction and persecution and misunderstandings that we've all had, the betrayals that we've had, and each one of us have had this. It recalls things that we wish were different. Turn with me, if you would, to now Deuteronomy chapter 11. Here's the difference. What's interesting about going to Deuteronomy chapter 11, we're not going to read it all. Those of you who are in the Bible study, we're not going to read the whole thing. I'm not going to play it for you. Deuteronomy chapter 11 and verse 1. God is speaking to Israel, and they're ready in some future date to go over Jordan. He says, because of what he said in chapter 10 at the end, he says the connecting word, therefore. Therefore, because of what was said, you shall love the Eternal your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments always. Always. And the reason is because God has been so good to them, has sheltered them. And then he directs it very carefully to a specific group of people, and only those people. Now remember, keep the setting in your mind. There's all Israel, men, women, and children. There's maybe the children and the women are in the back. But there's a whole group. There may be some strangers, some foreigners that are listening. He says, verse 2, know today that I do not speak with your children who have not known and who have not seen the chastening or the discipline of the Eternal your God, his greatness and his mighty hand and his outstretched arm, his signs and his acts which he did in the midst of Egypt, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all his land, what he did to the army of Egypt, to their horses, their chariots, how he made the waters of the Red Sea overflow them as they pursued you, and how the Eternal has destroyed them to this day, what he did for you in the wilderness until you came to this place, and what he did to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, the son of Reuben, how the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, their households, their tents, and all the substance that was in the possession in the midst of all Israel. But your eyes have seen every great act of the Eternal which he did. Brethren, God is speaking, I believe, when we read this, also by extension to us. If he isn't, then it's just raw, pure history. If we can't apply this, then it's just a story. It's just a part of the Old Testament, one of the many stories, and that's nice. That's really sweet, if there's no application. I think one of the greatest things that we need to remember and also to realize and to recall to mind without failing, without ceasing, are the great and wonderful things that God has done, not for the church, as important as that is, but what he has done for each and every person. It is a personal thing. When I relate to you this great trip that we had to London, I can't use the right words. I could show you pictures. We took 1,000. Would you like to see them? Yeah. I mean, after picture, 300? 400, you'd be pretty... I'm bored looking at them, and I was there. But I can't convey to you what we did. I can't convey to you the sights, the smells, the sounds, the interactions, the aura, because you weren't there. I was there. And brethren, I wasn't there when you went through the great things that have happened to you, the multiple times. The multiple times. We've also seen the great gifts that God has given to each one of us, collectively to be sure, but individually even more important. The road that we have been on is a tortuous one. Those of you that have been in the church the last 30 to 35 years, this has not been a smooth ride, has it? It's had a few bumps. We've lost a few off the bus. The bumps were so big and so ruts were so deep, didn't we? I'm hoping and praying the bus slows down a little bit, the road gets a little smoother, and those people we can pick back up. That's what I pray for. But this road has been grinding and arduous, but it must be viewed as the better path. This is not the wide, smooth freeway getting us there in record time. It has allowed us to see the great things that God has done, the beauty, just like Highway 1, the beautiful trees, the beautiful coast, the majesty that God gives us, the truth that he gives us, just like Highway 1, the many miracles. And you know what? That's the stuff we've seen. What about the things that have happened to you that you don't even know about, that you're not even aware of? The seen and the unseen. Deuteronomy 11 works with Matthew 7, I believe, because your eyes have seen great tragedy, haven't they? Most of us, or all of us, have seen great tragedy. But we've also seen great deliverance. And God has done this. And God says to remember this. These are personal issues, private issues. God says, remember this. God allows us to see these things with your eyes and with your eyes only. Only your eyes have seen many of these things. They will never be experienced by another, and neither can they be, though you tell them with a thousand words. The vistas, the landscapes, the wonder of this journey on this road through this narrow and difficult gate, recall God's work. We overlook this, I think, so many times. We ask too much of God, and we overlook it. I overlook it. I take it for granted. We often lose the remembrances that God has given us because many times, brethren, I know I do, we hold them in such low esteem. Good things to us, especially here, are all too commonplace. We can get just about anything we want, can't we? We can get just about anything we want. We become ungrateful. Ungrateful of the miracles which God and the goodness that God has given to us, and we become just a part of those people on that other road. And we say to God, or about God, what's he done for me lately? What's the next miracle? When is he going to deliver? And we fail to grow. Isn't it strange, though, and I think you'll agree, that those people who are sometimes the most faithful are the most appreciative? Those that have seen such great tragedy and suffered so greatly are some of the most stalwart, the most positive. They remember every step of a miracle. Many times they're in one tragedy right after another. That'll keep you humble, won't it? But if you're continually delivered again and again, the result is worth it. Those of us that call ourselves disciples will see God bring us from the brink again and again, as he has in the past, he will in the future. And that's what the first message was all about faith. Not our great faith in God, but faith that we have in a great God. Disciples do not have an easy road. They sometimes don't think they're ever going to get it right, but the results are always, always worth it. One has to ask themselves, you keep showing up here every Sabbath. You're either gluttons for punishment, don't know any better, you're absolutely crazy, or you're here because you do believe God does work in your life. He works in the lives of those that you love. Chuck Swindoll said, and I quote, "The avoidance of legitimate suffering means we also avoid the growth that the problems demand of us." Isn't that true? Those that have gone through great things, tragedies in many cases, and come out better the other side, those are the ones that we seek for counsel, don't we? We seek those people that we know have wisdom and wisdom through adversity because we know that they have grown. They have answers. They understand. You would never go to someone to ask them a question where you knew they didn't have the answer. That would be foolish. So we go to those people who have grown, they've understood, they've been through it. Jesus warns us that there will be tribulation and it will be upon us. Remember, it may be tribulation on the church, but the tribulation is going to be upon people, individuals, on you and me. But we see God's hand like a father leading his children. It's when the child pulls his hand away that the child stumbles. So as long as he stays connected to the Father, he knows he will be safe. That means that with this suffering and this affliction, we are to learn. I think these two sets of verses do go together because Jesus' audience in Matthew chapter 7 would have known Deuteronomy 11, probably verbatim. They would have heard these stories over and over again from their fathers, passed down generation after generation, that God talked directly to those people who have seen things and have been transposed to those in that generation and in this generation who have seen also these mighty acts. I think they very much go together. This church, this body, you people, have seen great miracles. They may be small to someone else. They're great to you. They're unbelievably huge to you. They don't mean much to someone else. We nod and we'll say, that's wonderful. We thank God for that. But it's not the same, is it? It's really not the same. The journey that you are on is not mine. It's not even similar. If you're married, our spouses, our children, the roads are all different, completely different. They're individual, and God works with us individually as our personality dictates. One of the things that grapes, when they get crushed down, and I had to be really careful with this one, grapes, when they're crushed down, guess what happens? It becomes this. It's empty. Don't tell the Adventists, it's empty. This, when it's crushed, becomes this. You can't get that in the bottle like that. They have to be crushed again and again and again. They go through a tremendous cycle, a chemical cycle of fermentation and aging. And that's what happens to grapes. The analogy is the same. In fact, that this road is almost picturesque, and it's the rut that the press pushes down, either grain or salt or grapes. That's what happens to us, brethren. Sometimes we feel like the grapes, but God's trying to make wine. Good wine. Great wine. Because there are indeed two gates, there are two doors. One is broad and wide and easy to get to. There's really no problems with it. In fact, you may just fall asleep while you're on that road. It'll be a great sleep. And there'll be somebody there taking care of that person who falls asleep on the broad and wide road. But Jesus says that we have a journey. Each and every one of us has a journey to go through the narrow, hard-to-find, and difficult gate. Because that gate leads to eternal life. And it's surrounded by this faith that we have in God. And it leads to eternal life forevermore with God and with those of God. So I ask you, brethren, as you pray to the Father, that indeed, if you feel like a grape and you've chosen this gate, know one day that you will become something wonderful that God is preparing through all this process. So, brethren, choose that narrow, choose that difficult gate.